The rain fell on Leshp so hard it probably hadn't been worth the island's bother of rising from the bottom of the sea. Most of the explorers slept in their boats now. There were buildings on the risen island, but the buildings weren't quite right. Solid Jackson peered out from the tarpaulin he'd rigged up on deck. Mist was rising off the soaking ground and was made luminous by the occasional flash of lightning. The city, by stormlight, looked far too malevolent. There were things he could recognise, columns and steps and archways and so on, but there were others. He shuddered. It looked as if people had once tried to add human touches to structures that were already ancient. It was because of his son that everyone was staying in the boats. A party of Ankh Morpork fishermen had gone ashore that morning to search for the heaps of treasure that everyone knew littered the ocean bottom and had found a tiled floor washed clean by the rain. Pretty blue and white squares showed a pattern of waves and shells, and in the middle a squid. And Les had said, "That looks pretty big, Dad." And everyone had looked around at the weed-covered buildings and had shared the thought, which remained unspoken, but was made up of a lot of little thoughts, like the occasional ripples in the pools and the little splashes in the dark water of cellars that made the mind think of claws, winnowing the deeps, and the odd things that sometimes got washed up on the beaches or turned up in nets. Sometimes you pulled things over the side that had put a man off fish for life. And suddenly, no one wanted to explore any more, just in case they found something. Solid Jackson pulled his head back under the cover.
"Why ain't we going home, Dad?" said his son. "You said this place gives you the willies."
"All right, but there aren't more pork willies, see? And no foreigner's going to get his hands on them."
"Dad?"
"Yes, lad?"
"Who was Mr. Hong?"
"How should I know?"
"Only when we was all heading back for the boats, one of the other men said, 'We all know what happened to Mr. Hong when he opened the Three Jolly Luck Takeaway Fish Bar on the site of the old fish god temple in Dagon Street on the night of the full moon, don't we?' Well, I don't know."
"Ah." Solid Jackson hesitated. Still, Les was a big lad now.
"He closed up and left in a bit of a hurry, lad. So quick he had to leave some things behind."
"Like what?"
"If you must know, half an ear hole and one kidney."
"Cool."
The boat rocked and wood splintered. Jackson jerked the cover up. Spray washed over him. Somewhere close in the wet darkness, a voice shouted,
"Why you not carrying lights, you second cousin of a jackal?"
Jackson pulled out the lantern and held it up.
"What are you doing in Ankh Morpork territorial waters, you camel-eating devil?"
"These waters belong to us.
We were here first."
"Yeah, we were here first."
"We were here first."
"You damaged my boat. That's piracy, that is."
There were other shouts around them. In the darkness, the two flotillas had collided. Bowsprits tore away rigging, hulls boomed. The controlled panic that is normal sailing became the frantic panic composed of darkness, spray, and too much rigging coming unrigged. At times like this, the ancient traditions of the sea that unite all mariners should come to the fore and see them combine in the face of their common foe, the hungry and relentless ocean. However, at this point, Mr. Arif hit Mr. Jackson over the head with an oar.
What?
Vimes opened the only eye that appeared to respond. A horrible sight met it.
"I read him his rights, whereupon he said, 'Up yours, copper.' Sergeant Detritus then cautioned him, upon which he said, 'Ouch.'"
"There may be a lot of things I'm not good at," thought Vimes, "but at least I don't treat the punctuation of a sentence like a game of pin the tail on the donkey." He rolled his head away from Carrot's fractured grammar. The pile of paper shifted under him. Vimes's desk was becoming famous. Once there were piles, but they had slipped as piles do, forming this dense, compacted layer that was now turning into something like peat. It was said there were plates and unfinished meals somewhere down there. No one wanted to check. Some people said they'd heard movement. There was a genteel cough. Vimes rolled his head again and looked up into the big, pink face of Willikins, Lady Sybil's butler. His butler, too, technically, although Vimes hated to think of him like that.
"I think we had better proceed with alacrity, Sir Samuel. I have brought your dress uniform, and your shaving things are by the basin."
"What? What?
You are due at the university in half an hour. Lady Sybil has vouchsafed to me that if you are not there, she will utilize your intestines for hosiery accessories, sir.
Was she smiling? Said Vimes, staggering to his feet and making his way to the steaming basin on the washstand.
Only slightly, sir.
Oh, gods.
Yes, sir.
Vimes made an attempt at shaving, while behind him Willikins brushed and polished. Outside, the city's clocks began to strike 10. It must have been almost 4 when I sat down, Vimes thought. I know I heard the shift change at 8, and then I had to sort out Nobby's expenses. That's advanced mathematics if ever there was some. He tried to yawn and shave at the same time, which is never a good idea.
Damn!
I shall fetch some tissue paper directly, sir, said Willikins, without looking round.
As Vimes dabbed at his chin, the butler went on, I should like to take this opportunity to raise a matter of some import, sir.
Yes.
Vimes stared blearily at the red tights that seemed to be a major item of his dress uniform.
Regretfully, I am afraid I must ask leave to give my notice, sir. I wish to join the colours.
Which colours are these, Willikins? Said Vimes, holding up a shirt with puffed sleeves.
Then his brain caught up with his ears.
You want to become a soldier?
They say Clatch needs to be taught a sharp lesson, sir. A Willikins has never been found wanting when his country calls. I thought that Lord Venturi's heavy infantry would do for me. They have a particularly attractive uniform of red and white, sir, with gold fogging.
Vimes pulled his boots on.
You've had military experience, have you?
Oh, no, sir, but I am a quick learner, sir, and I believe I have some prowess with the carving knife.
The butler's face showed a patriotic alertness.
On turkeys? And on, said Vimes.
Yes, sir, said Willikins, buffing up the ceremonial helmet. And you're off to fight the screaming hordes in Clatch, are you? If it should come to that, sir, said Willikins, I think this is adequately polished now, sir.
A very sandy place, so they say.
Indeed, sir,
said Willikins, adjusting the helmet under Vimes's chin.
And rocky, very rocky, lots of rocks. Dusty, too.
Very parched in parts, sir, I believe you are correct.
And so into this land of sand-coloured dust and sand-coloured rocks and sand-coloured you, Willikins, will march with your expertise in cutlery and your red-and-white uniform.
With the gold frogging, sir?
Willikins thrust out his jaw.
Yes, sir. If the need arises.
You don't see anything wrong with this picture, sir?
Oh, never mind,
Vimes yawned.
Well, we shall miss you, Willikins.
Others may not, he thought, especially if they have time for a second shot.
Oh, Lord Venturi says it'll all be over by Hogswatch, sir.
Really? I didn't know it had started.
Vimes ran down the stairs and into a smell of curry.
We saved you some, sir, said Sergeant Colon. You was asleep when the lad brought it round.
It was Goriff's kid,
said Nobby, chasing a bit of rice around his tin plate.
Enough for half the shift.
The rewards of duty,
said Vimes, hurrying towards the door.
Bread and mango, pickle and everything,
said Colon happily.
I've always said old Goriff isn't that bad for a raghead.
A pool of sizzling oil. Vimes stopped at the door, the family huddling together. He took out his watch. It was 10:20. If he ran...
Fred, could you just step up to my office, he said. It won't take a moment.
Right, sir.
Vimes ushered the sergeant up the stairs and closed the door. Nobby and the other watchman strained to listen, but there was no sound except for a low murmuring, which went on for some time. The door opened again. Vimes came down the stairs.
Nobby, come up to the university in 5 minutes, will you? I want to stay in touch, and I'm damned if I'm taking a pigeon with this uniform on.
Right, sir.
Vimes left. A few moments later, Sergeant Colon walked carefully down to the main office. He had a slightly glassy look and walked back to his desk with the nonchalance that only the extremely worried try to achieve. He toyed with some paper for a while and then said,
"You don't mind what people call you, do you, Nobby?"
"I'd be minding the whole time if I minded that, Sarge,"
said Corporal Nobbs cheerfully.
"Right, right. And I don't mind what people call me, neither."
Colon scratched his head.
"Don't make sense, really.
I reckon Sir Sam is missing too much sleep. He's a very busy man, Fred. Trying to do everything, that's his trouble. And Nobby, yes? It's Sergeant Colon, thanks.
There was sherry. There was always sherry at these occasions. Sam Vimes could regard it dispassionately, since he always drank fruit juice these days. He'd heard they made sherry by letting wine go rotten. He couldn't see the point of sherry.
"And you will try to look dignified, won't you?"
said Lady Sybil, adjusting his cloak.
"Yes, dear."
"What will you try to look?"
"Dignified, dear."
"And please try to be diplomatic."
"Yes, dear."
"What will you try to be?"
"Diplomatic, dear."
"You're using your henpecked voice, Sam."
"Yes, dear."
"You know that's not fair."
"No, dear."
Vimes raised a hand in a theatrical gesture of submission.
"All right, all right. It's just these feathers and these tights."
He winced and tried to do some surreptitious rearranging in an effort to prevent himself becoming the city's first hunch groin.
"I mean, supposing people see me."
"Of course they'll see you, Sam. You're leading the procession. And I'm very proud of you."
She brushed some lint off his shoulder. Women always do this.
"Feathers in my hat," Vimes thought glumly, "and fancy tights, and a shiny breastplate. A breastplate shouldn't be shiny. It should be too dented to take a decent polish. And diplomatic talk? How should I know how to talk diplomatically?"
"And now I must go and have a word with Lady Solarchi," said Lady Sybil. "You'll be all right, will you? You keep yawning."
"Of course. Didn't get much sleep last night, that's all."
"You promise not to run away?"
"Me? I never run."
"You ran away before the big soiree of the genuine ambassador. Everyone saw you."
"I'd just got news that the debris gang were robbing Vortin's strongroom."
"But you don't have to chase everyone, Sam. You employ people for that now."
"We got 'em, though," said Vimes with satisfaction.
He'd enjoyed it immensely, too. It wasn't just the pursuit that was so invigorating, with his velvet cloak left behind on a tree and his hat in a puddle somewhere. It was the knowledge that while he was doing this, he wasn't eating very small sandwiches and making even smaller talk. It wasn't proper police work, Vimes considered, unless you were doing something that someone somewhere would much rather you weren't doing. When Sybil had disappeared into the crowd, he found a handy shadow and lurked in it. It enabled him to see almost the whole of the university's great hall. He quite liked wizards. They didn't commit crimes. Not Vimes's type of crimes, anyway. The occult wasn't Vimes's beat. The wizards might well mess up the very fabric of time and space, but they didn't lead to paperwork, and that was fine by Vimes. There were a lot of them in the hall, in all their glory, and there was nothing finer than a wizard dressed up formally, until someone could find a way of inflating a bird of paradise, possibly by using an elastic band and some kind of gas. But the wizards were getting a run for their money, because the rest of the guests were either nobles or guild leaders or both, and an occasion like the convivium brought out the peacock in everyone. His gaze went from face to chatting face, and he wondered idly what each person was guilty of. The possibility that they were not guilty of anything was one that he didn't even think worthy of consideration. Quite a few of the ambassadors were there, too. They were easy to pick out. They wore their national costumes. But since by and large their national costumes were what the average peasant wore, they looked slightly out of place in them. Their bodies wore feathers and silks, but their minds persistently wore suits. They chatted in small groups. One or two nodded and smiled to him as they passed. The world is watching, Vimes thought. If something went wrong and this stupid Leshp business started a war, it's men like these who'd be working out exactly how to deal with the winner, whoever it was. Never mind who started it, never mind how it was fought, they'd want to know how to deal with things now. They represented what people called the international community. And like all uses of the word community, you were never quite sure what or who it was. He shrugged. It wasn't his world, thank goodness. He sidled over to Corporal Nobbs, who was standing by the main doors in the sort of lopsided slouch which was the closest a living Nobbs could come to attention.
"All quiet, Nobby," he said out of the corner of his mouth.
"Yes, sir."
"Nothing going on at all?"
"No, sir. Not a pigeon anywhere, sir."
"What, nowhere? Nothing?"
"No, sir."
"There was trouble all over the place yesterday."
"Yes, sir."
"You did tell Fred he was to send a bird if there was anything at all?"
"Yes, sir."
"The shades? There's always something."
"Dead quiet, sir."
"Damn."
Vimes shook his head at the sheer untrustworthiness of Ankh Morpork's criminal fraternity. I suppose you couldn't take a brick and...
Lady Sybil was very specific about how you was to stop here,
said Corporal Nobbs, staring straight ahead.
Specific? Yeah, sir. She come and have a word with me. Gave me a dollar, said Nobby.
Ah, Sir Samuel, said a booming voice behind him. I don't think you've met Prince Kufura yet, have you?
He turned. Arch-Chancellor Ridcully was bearing down on him, towing a couple of swarthy men. Vimes hurriedly put on his official face. This is Commander Vimes, gentlemen. Sam, no, I'm doing this the wrong way round, aren't I? Got the protocol all wrong. So much to sort out. The bursar's locked himself in the safe again. We don't know how he manages to get the key in there with him. I mean, it's not even as if it's got a keyhole on the inside. The first man held out a hand as Ridcully bustled off again.
Prince Kufura, he said. My carpet got in only 2 hours ago.
Carpet? Oh, yes, you flew.
Yes, very chilly, and of course you can't get a good meal. And did you get your man, Sir Samuel?
What? Pardon?
I believe our ambassador told me you had to leave the reception last week.
The prince was a tall man, who had probably once been quite athletic until the big dinners had finally weighed him down, and he had a beard. All Clatchians had beards. This Clatchian had intelligent eyes, too. Disconcertingly intelligent. You looked into them and several layers of person looked back at you. What? Oh, yes. Yes, we got him all right, said Vimes.
Well done. He put up a fight, I see.
Vimes looked surprised. The prince tapped his jaw thoughtfully. Vimes's hand flew up and encountered a little bit of tissue on his own chin. Yes.
Commander Vimes always gets his man, said the prince.
Well, I wouldn't say it.
Veterinarius Terrier, I've heard them call you,
the prince went on.
Always hot on the chase, they say, and he won't let go.
Vimes stared into the calm, knowing gaze. I suppose at the end of the day we're all someone's dog, he said weakly.
In fact, it is fortuitous I have met you, Commander.
It is?
I was just wondering about the meaning of the word shouted at me as we were on our way down here. Could you be so kind? I believe it was... Let me see now. Oh, yes. Towelhead.
The prince's eyes stayed locked on Vimes's face. Vimes was conscious of his own thoughts moving very fast, and they seemed to reach their own decision. We'll explain later, they said. You're too tired for explanations. Right now, with this man, it's oh so much better to be honest.
It refers to your headdress, he said.
Oh, is it some kind of obscure joke?
Of course he knows, thought Vimes, and he knows I know.
No, it's an insult, he said eventually.
Ha! Huh. Well, we certainly cannot be held responsible for the ramblings of idiots, Commander.
The prince flashed a smile.
I must commend you, incidentally.
I'm sorry?
For your breadth of knowledge. I must have asked a dozen people that question this morning, and do you know, not one of them knew what it meant, and they all seemed to have caught a cough.
There was a diplomatic pause, but in it someone sniggered. Vimes let his glance drift sideways to the other man, who had not been introduced. He was shorter and skinnier than the prince, and under his black headdress he had the most crowded face Vimes had ever seen. A network of scars surrounded a nose like an eagle's beak. There was a sort of beard and moustache, but the scars had affected the hair growth so much that they stuck out in strange bunches at odd angles. The man looked as though he had been hit in the mouth by a hedgehog. He could have been any age. Some of the scars looked fresh. All in all, the man had a face that any policeman would arrest on sight. There was no possible way it could be innocent of anything. He caught Vimes' expression and grinned. And Vimes had never seen so much gold in one mouth. He'd never seen so much gold in one place. Vimes realized he was staring when he ought to have been making polite, diplomatic conversation.
So, he said, are we going to have a scrap over this Lesh business or what?
The prince gave a dismissive shrug.
He said. A few square miles of uninhabited fertile ground, with superb anchorage in an unsurpassed strategic position? What sort of inconsequence is that for civilized people to war over?
Once again, Vimes felt the gaze on him, reading him. Well, the hell with it, he said. Sorry, I'm not good at this diplomacy business. Did you mean what you said just then? There was another snigger. Vimes turned and looked at the leering, bearded face again, and was aware of a smell, no, a stench, of cloves. Good grief! He chews the stinking things.
Ah, said the prince, you haven't met 71-hour Ahmed.
Ahmed grinned again and bowed.
Effendi,
he said, in a voice like a gravel path. And that seemed to be it. Not, this is 71-hour Ahmed cultural attaché, or 71-hour Ahmed my bodyguard, or even 71-hour Ahmed walking strong room and moth killer. It was clear that the next move was up to Vimes.
That's an unusual name, he said. Not at all, said the prince smoothly. Ahmed is a very common name in my country.
He leaned forward again. Vimes recognized this as the prelude to a confidential aside.
Incidentally, was that beautiful lady I saw just now your first wife?
All my wives, said Vimes. That is,
could I offer you 20 camels for her?
Vimes looked back into the dark eyes for a moment, glanced at 71-hour Ahmed's 24-carat grin, and said, this is another test, isn't it? The prince straightened up, looking pleased.
Well done, Sir Samuel, you're good at this. Do you know Mr. Boggis of the Thieves' Guild was prepared to accept 15?
For Mrs. Boggis?
Vimes waggled a hand dismissively.
Nah, four camels, maybe four camels and a goat in a good light, and when she's had a shave.
The milling guests turned at the sound of the prince's explosion of laughter.
Very good, very good. I'm afraid, Commander, that some of your fellow citizens feel that just because my people invented advanced mathematics and all-day camping, we are complete barbarians who try to buy their wives at the drop of, shall we say, a turban. I am surprised they're giving me an honorary degree, considering how incredibly backward I am.
Oh, what degree is that? Said Vimes. No wonder this man was a diplomat. You couldn't trust him an inch. He thought in loops, and you couldn't help liking him despite it. The prince pulled a letter out of his robe.
Apparently it's a Doctorum Adamus cum flabello dulci. Is there something wrong, Sir Samuel?
Vimes managed to turn the treacherous laugh into a coughing fit.
No, no, nothing, he said. No.
He desperately wanted to change the subject. Unfortunately, there was something here to provide just the opportunity.
Why has Mr. Ahmed got such a big curved sword slung on his back? He said.
Ah, you are a policeman. You notice such things.
It's hardly a concealed weapon, is it? It's nearly bigger than him. He's practically a concealed owner.
It's ceremonial, said the prince, and he does fret so if he has to leave it behind.
And what exactly is his... Ah, there you are, said Ridcully. I think we're just about ready. You know, you go right at the front, Sam.
Yes, I know, said Vimes. I was just asking His Highness what...
And if you, Your Highness, and you, Mr... Oh, my word, what a big sword. And you come back here and take your place among the honoured guests, and we'll be ready in a brace of shakes.
What a thing it is to have a copper's mind, Vimes thought, as the great file of wizards and guests tried to form a dignified and orderly line behind him. Just because someone makes himself pleasant and likable, you start to be suspicious of him, for no other reason than the fact that anyone who goes out of their way to be nice to a copper has got something on their mind. Of course, he's a diplomat, but still, I just hope he never studied ancient languages, and that's a fact. Someone tapped Vimes on the shoulder. He turned and looked right into the grin of 71-hour Ahmed.
If you changing your mind, Effendi, I give you 25 camels, no problem,
he said, pulling a clove from his teeth.
May your loins be full of fruit.
He winked. It was the most suggestive gesture Vimes had ever seen. Is this another... he began, but the man had vanished into the crowd. My loins be full of fruit, he repeated to himself. Good grief. 71-hour Ahmed reappeared at his other elbow in a gust of cloves.
I go. I come back, he growled happily. The prince says the decree is daughter of sweet Fanny Adams. A wizard we, yes? Oh, how we are laughing.
And then he was gone. The convivium was Unseen University's big day. Originally, it had just been the degree ceremony, but over the years, it had developed into a kind of celebration of the amicable relationship between the university and the city, in particular celebrating the fact that people were hardly ever turned to clams anymore. In the absence of anything resembling a Lord Mayor's show or a state opening of Parliament, it was one of the few formal opportunities the citizens had of jeering at their social superiors, or at least at people wearing tights and ridiculous costumes. It had grown so big that it was now held in the city's opera house. Distrustful people, that is to say people like Vimes, considered that this was so there could be a procession. There was nothing like the massed ranks of wizardry walking sedately through the city in a spirit of civic amicability to subtly remind the more thoughtful kind of person that it hadn't always been this way. Look at us, the wizards seemed to be saying. We used to rule this city. Look at our big staffs with the knobs on the end. Any one of these could do some very serious damage in the wrong hands, so it's a good thing, isn't it, that they're in the right hands at the moment. Isn't it nice that we all get along so well? And someone once had decided that the commander of the watch should walk in front, for symbolic reasons. That hadn't mattered for years because there hadn't been a commander of the watch. But now there was, and he was Sam Vimes, in a red shirt, with silly baggy sleeves, red tights, some kind of puffed shorts in a style that went out of fashion by the look of it at the time when Flint was at the cutting edge of cutting-edge technology, a tiny, shiny breastplate, and a helmet with feathers in it. And he really did need some sleep. And he had to carry the truncheon. He kept his eyes fixed on the damn thing as he walked out of the university's main gate. Last night's rain had cleaned the sky. The city steamed. If he stared at the truncheon, he didn't have to see who was giggling at him. The downside was that he had to keep staring at the thing. It said, on a little tarnished shield that he'd had to clean before reading it, Protector of the King's Peace. That had brightened the occasion slightly. Feathers and antiques, gold braid and fur. Perhaps it was because he was tired, or just because he was trying to shut out the world, but Vimes found himself slowing down into the traditional watchman's walk and the traditional idling thought process. It was an almost Pavlovian response, a term invented by the wizard De Nephew Boot, who had found that by a system of rewards and punishments, he could train a dog at the ringing of a bell to immediately eat a strawberry meringue. De Nephew's parents, who were uncomplicated country people, had wanted a girl. They were expecting to call her Denise. The legs swung, the feet moved, the mind began to work in a certain way. It wasn't a dream state, exactly. It was just that the ears, nose, and eyeballs wired themselves straight into the ancient, suspicious bastard node of his brain, leaving his higher brain center free to freewheel. Fur and tights. What kind of wear was that for a watchman? Bashed-in armor, greasy leather breeches, and a tatty shirt with bloodstains on it. Someone else's, for preference. That was the stuff. Nice feel of the cobbles through his boots. It was really comforting. Behind him, confusion running up and down the ranks, the procession slowed down to keep in step. Protector of the King's Peace, indeed. He'd said to the old man who delivered it, "What peace did you have in mind?" But that had fallen on stony ears. Damn silly thing anyway, he thought. A short length of wood with a lump of silver on the end. Even a constable got a decent sword. What was he supposed to do? Wave it at people? Ye gods, it was months since he'd had a good walk through the streets. A lot of people about today. Some parade on, wasn't there? Oh dear, said Captain Carrot in the crowd. What's he doing? Next to him, an Agatian tourist was industriously pulling the lever off his iconograph. Commander Vimes stopped and, with a faraway look in his eyes, tucked his truncheon under one arm and reached up to his helmet. The tourist looked up at Carrot and tugged his shirt politely.
Please, what is he doing now? He said.
He's taking out... Oh, no, said Angua. "He's taking the ceremonial packet of cigars out of his helmet," said Carrot. "And he's... oh, he's lighting one." The tourist pulled the lever a few times.
"Very historic tradition?"
"Memorable," murmured Angua. The crowd had fallen silent. No one wanted to break Vimes' concentration. There was the big, gusty silence of 1,000 people holding their breath. "What's he doing now?" said Carrot. "Can't you see?" said Angua. "Not with my hands over my eyes. Oh, the poor man. He's just blown a smoke ring. First one of the day. He always does that. And now he's set off again, and now he's pulled out the truncheon, and he's tossing it up in the air and catching it again. You know the way he does with his sword when he's thinking. He looks quite happy." "I think he's going to really treasure this moment of happiness," said Carrot. Then the murmur started. The procession had halted behind Vimes. Some of the more impressionable people who weren't sure what they should be doing, and those who had partaken too heavily of the university's rather good sherry, started to fumble around on their person for something to throw up in the air and catch. After all, this was a traditional ceremony. If you took the view that you were not going to do things because they were apparently ridiculous, you might as well go home right now.